Yesterday we looked at the important place of risk and risk-taking in living by faith, and I particularly emphasized the line, no one ever regretted trusting Christ more, ever. And now this morning we're going to be looking at faith and doubt. And we'll start with Tim Keller quote. A faith without some doubts is like a human body without any antibodies in it. People who blithely go through life too busy or indifferent to ask hard questions about why they believe as they do will find themselves defenseless against either the experience of tragedy or the probing questions of a smart skeptic. A person's faith can collapse almost overnight if she has failed over the years to listen to her own doubts, which should only be discarded after long reflection. Believers should acknowledge and wrestle with doubts, not only their own, but their friends and neighbors. I think that's a good quote, so I'm going to say it again. A faith without some doubts is like a human body without any antibodies in it. People who blithely go through life too busy or indifferent to ask hard questions about why they believe as they do will find themselves defenseless against either the experience of tragedy or the probing questions of a smart skeptic. A person's faith can collapse almost overnight if she has failed over the years to listen to her own doubts, which should only be discarded after long reflection. Believers should acknowledge and wrestle with doubts, not only their own, but their friends and neighbors. So we'll just pause for a moment there, and I want you to think, when we use the word doubt, before I start giving examples, what are the doubts and questions that come to mind for you? So partly just, what are the doubts and questions that you spring to mind as falling under the all-inclusive category of doubt? But then more specifically, which of these are your questions, your big questions and doubts? So yesterday we looked through our Hebrews 11 passage and took note of some of the faith risks taken by this great cloud of witnesses. And we could go back through and look at the doubts of a number of the big names in this chapter, particularly Abraham and Sarah, or Gideon, who was another big doubter who's mentioned. But instead we're going to focus in on Moses and the nation of Israel. And with Moses, we'll be looking at the link between doubting oneself and doubting God. And then as we consider the doubt of Israel, we'll be looking at the head and heart components of doubt. So first, looking at Moses, we're going to look at Exodus 3 and 4. So if you want to turn there and have those chapters open. So, we'll not read it all, but in chapter 3, verse 10, we see that God says to Moses, "So now, go. I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt." And then the rest of the dialogue really consists of God responding to Moses' doubts. So I'm going to get some other people to do some reading. Maybe we'll just go around this way, if you all have Bibles.
11.
So, 3 verse 11, and then 3 verse 13, Claire. Mm-hmm. And then Emmy, 4 verse 1, and Matt, 4 verse 10. So, if you just want to read them out one after the other.
But Moses said to God, "Who am I,
that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt.
Then Moses asked God, if I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is his name, what should I tell them?
Moses answered, what if they do not believe me or listen to me and say, the Lord did not appear to you?
Moses said to the Lord, pardon your servant, Lord. I have never been eloquent, neither in the past or nor since you have spoken to your servant. I am slow of speech and tongue.
Great, thank you. So the first thing to note about Moses' doubts is that they combine both doubts about himself and doubts about God. Although it seems his doubts mostly center around himself. But then it's particularly interesting to look at how God responds to his doubts. So first, we notice that God, or when we read it, we'll notice that God always responds graciously. There's no indication that he's angry or upset at Moses doubting. And he meets Moses where he is. He takes his questions and his doubts seriously, and he answers them. And then we'll look at the content of God's responses. So Moses' first question again is, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? And this is very much a doubt about himself and his suitability for this particular calling. But although Moses' question centers around himself, God's answer doesn't focus on Moses at all. So Moses asks, who am I that I should be suitable for this calling? And God doesn't say, Moses, you're the best person I could find for the job. You're super amazing. Instead, he says, I will be with you. That's what Moses needs to know here. And then we see a similar dynamic in Moses' fourth expression of doubt. So in chapter 4, verse 10, Moses says that he's a poor speaker. And again, it's a doubt about himself. And God's response is brilliant here. He doesn't argue with Moses. He just says, who gave man his mouth? So I'd say that throughout this passage, we see that doubts about God and doubts about self are intimately bound together. Moses maybe thinks he's just doubting himself, but we see from God's answers that that is not what God thinks. So there's two implications for us that I want to draw from this passage so far. First, we see quite clearly that God can handle our doubts. They don't seem to offend him. And second, we see that the answer to doubts that appear to be about ourselves is often to look at God and truth about him. So I'll give you three examples of common doubts that fit this pattern.
So what was the second one? So the first one is about in the Lord doubts.
Mm-hmm. So second, we see that the answer to doubts that appear to be about ourselves is often to look to God and truth about him. So three examples of common doubts that fit that pattern, where the doubt seems to be about ourselves, but the answer is about God. So first, how could God love me? Second, how could God forgive me? Third, how could God use me? And these all sound like doubts about oneself, about me. But the reality is that I'll never find a good answer by looking at myself. I need to look to God. So the answer to how could God love me is not because I'm just so lovable. The answer is found in looking at the nature of a God who is love. Similarly, the answer to how could God forgive me is not found in myself, but in looking to the cross. And the answer to how could God use me is very much the same answer that he gave to Moses, I will be with you. And each of those questions could have a talk of their own. But now there's one final statement from Moses in this dialogue, so we'll move on to that now. So far, Moses has expressed a series of doubts, and God has always responded graciously, but this time it seems to be different. So if we pick up in 4:13, we read, "But Moses said, 'Pardon your servant, Lord. Please send someone else.' Then the Lord's anger burned against Moses." So, as we know, God wasn't angry about any of Moses' previous doubts. So, what's different this time? Did any of you manage to think about this in your quiet times? Or even just now? What do you think might be different this time? Why is God reacting differently this time? Why is he upset and angry?
Because this time Moses is directly questioning God's choice. Mm-hmm. So previously he was kind of saying, "Hey God, like, these are questions that are going to be asked. How do I respond to them? This is a, God, I am not able to do this. I don't have the power, the strength. I'm not good enough for it." And that's what made God angry, because God was telling him, "Hey, I'm going with you. I'm telling you to do this. I will be with you when you do this." Mm-hmm. And thus, you yourself are not doing it. It is me doing it through you. And Moses was taking it as, I have to do it myself, and I can't do it. And thus, he was limiting God's power.
Yeah. That's great. Any other thoughts?
It's kind of like the fall, like Moses is trying to be God, and that he's saying to God, like, it's almost like you don't understand, like, I actually can't do this, so yeah. you have to change this.
Uh-huh.
So it's like taking that power, like you're saying.
Yeah.
It's almost like he's asked all the questions and they've all been answered, and there's no excuses left, and
yeah.
It's kind of like, it's somebody else, but it's the kind of, I still, even despite God's assurance he's going to be with him, but I can't do this.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. Anyone else? Okay, so I very much agree with all that you've said. And I would suggest maybe that until now, it just seemed like doubt, whereas here, it now seems more like hard-heartedness. It's stubborn refusal. But it's interesting noting God's response again. So even here, although God is angry, he still meets Moses where he is. So Moses says that he can't do it, send someone else to do it. And so God says that he will give his brother to be his assistant. So he provides for Moses' felt limitations. It's also interesting to imagine God had said, "Okay, I'll send someone else." Just imagining what Moses would have missed out on if God had allowed him to have the final word. And then, of course, from here on, we see this huge transformation in the person of Moses as he becomes the great hero of faith that we know, and as he leads a nation of doubters and grumblers out of Egypt and then in the desert for 40 years. So we'll move on to those doubters and grumblers now, Israel. So it said in the blurb at the start of the leaflet thing about this session, "Despite the wonders God performs in the Exodus, the Israelites' journey through the wilderness is characterized by stories of both faith and doubt. And so if you know anything about the story of Israel, you hardly need reminded of the fact that they were doubters. Hebrews 11:29 commends them, saying, "By faith the people passed through the Red Sea as on dry land. But when the Egyptians tried to do so, they were drowned." But then it's only a few chapters later, in Exodus, that they're worshipping a golden calf. So they clearly struggled with this Hebrews 11 verse 1 idea of faith being assurance about what we do not see. They wanted a God that they could see. And actually, I guess we all want a God that we can see. And thinking back to Beth's talk about waiting, one of the greatest things that we have to wait patiently for is definitely seeing God face to face. But anyway, I now want to spend some time on another story that springs to mind for me when I think about Israel and Israel's doubt. So let's move now to Numbers 13 and 14. And just keep your Bibles open there. So here, 12 men are sent out from Israel to explore the Promised Land. And then we're going to pick up in Numbers 13, verse 26. Matt, can you read up to the end of the chapter?
Yes.
And then Beth, can you take over and read up to 14:12?
So 13:26?
Yeah.
And he came to Moses and Aaron and to the congregation of Israelites in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. They brought back word to them and to all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. And they told them, "We came to the land which you sent us. It flows with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. Yet the people who live in the land are strong, and the towns are fortified and very large. And besides, we saw the descendants of Anak there. The Mechalites live in the land of the Negev. The Hittites, the Jebusites, and the Amorites live in the hill country. And the Canaanites live by the sea and all along the Jordan." But Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, "Let us go up at once and occupy it, for we are well able to overcome it." Then the men who had gone up with him said, "We are not able to go up against this people, for they are stronger than we are." So they brought to the Israelites an unfavorable report of the land that they had spied out, saying, "The land that we have gone through as spies is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people that we saw in it are of great size. There we saw the Nephilim, the Anakites come from the Nephilim, and to ourselves we seemed like grasshoppers, and so we seemed to them."
And all the congregation raised a loud cry, and people wept that night, and all the Israelites complained against Moses and Aaron. The whole congregation said to them, "Would that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would that we had died in the wilderness. Why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become booty. Would it not be better for us to go back to Egypt?" So they said to one another, "Let us choose a captain and go back to Egypt." And Moses and Aaron fell on their faces before the assembly of the congregation of the Israelites. And Joshua, son of Nun, and Caleb, son of Jephunneh, who were among those who spied out the land, tore their clothes and said to all the congregation of the Israelites, "The land that we went through as spies is exceedingly good land. If the Lord is pleased with us, he will bring us to this land and give it to us, a land that flows with milk and honey. And we do not rebel against the Lord, and do not fear the people of the land, for they are no more than bread for us. Their protection is removed from them. The Lord is with us, do not fear them." But the whole congregation threatened to stone them. And the glory of the Lord appeared at the tent of meeting to all the Israelites. And the Lord said to Moses, "How long will the people despise me? And how long will they refuse to believe in me despite them? I will strike them with pestilence and disinherit them, and I will make you a nation greater and mightier than they."
Thank you. So, and then, if you know the story, Moses intercedes for the people, and instead of being wiped out, their punishment is to, of course, spend 40 years in the desert, until that generation has died off, and a new generation will then enter the promised land. And it's pretty bleak. If we were to skim over some significant details of the story, we could worry that this is a harsh punishment for mere doubt. But actually, the reason I want to look at this story is because it highlights the important distinction between doubt and unbelief. And they're not unrelated, but they're not the same thing. So, in this story, the people hear two conflicting reports about the Promised Land. And perhaps it would be an appropriate response to doubt and question. And similarly, we often hear conflicting things about who God is and what he has done and what he is doing and will do in the world. And we don't always know immediately which perspective is true. So coming to terms with the truth is often on the other side of questioning and doubt. But the Israelites skip that stage altogether. They bypass the stage of doubt and questioning, and they jump into fully fledged unbelief. And that unbelief works itself out in some pretty dire ways. So first, they give up hope. So 14:1, that night all the people of the community raised their voices and wept aloud. And they go on to say, if only we had died in Egypt or in the desert. Then second, they grumble against their leaders. Third, they essentially blaspheme God by slandering him. So they say in verse 3, why is the Lord bringing us to this land only to let us fall by the sword? Our wives and children will be taken as plunder. So it's a pretty horrible accusation against God, actually. Then fourth, they rebel and decide that they're going to return to slavery, that would be better. And fifth, they want to stone Joshua and Caleb. And this isn't what mere doubt looks like. This is deep-seated unbelief. Or as God puts it in 14 verse 11, they refuse to believe in me. It's not just that they're unpersuaded intellectually, they refuse to believe. They don't want to trust God, or they treat God with contempt, as he says in verse 11. And it's worth noting that when God says they refuse to believe in me, it's clearly not that they doubt his existence. Rather, they refuse to trust him. So we see here the belief is clearly more than intellectual. And this passage reminds me of Psalm 14, verse 1, where David says, the fool says in his heart, there is no God. And we might think of that statement, there is no God, as a head statement. But David doesn't say, the fool says there is no God, or the fool says in his mind, there is no God. David says, the fool says in his heart, there is no God. So he doesn't want God. He's hardened his heart before he even engages with the matter intellectually. And so why is all this important? Well, first, I really do want to affirm the valuable place and the necessary place of doubt in the Christian life. And I want to do so partly by distinguishing it from unbelief or hard-heartedness. And second, I want to acknowledge that there's an important head and heart component to both doubt and unbelief. And so when considering what might be seemingly intellectual doubts, we need to assess our hearts. We need to assess what our heart wants. So first, doubt is different from unbelief. And I think this fact frees us to open up about our doubts. So to quote this book, with a quote that I got from Steve, For many Christians, merely having doubts of any kind can be scary. They wonder whether their questions disqualify them from being a follower of Christ. They feel insecure because they're not sure whether it's permissible to express uncertainty about God, Jesus, or the Bible. So they keep their questions to themselves, and inside unanswered, they grow and fester and loom until they eventually succeed in choking out their faith. The shame is not that people have doubts, Oz Guinness once wrote, but that they are ashamed of them. So, to repeat that last line from Oz Guinness, the shame is not that people have doubts, but that they are ashamed of them. I spoke a bit about my brother, Sean, yesterday. And over the past year or so, I've been quite unsure as to where Sean stood with God. And I didn't feel I'd really had a good opportunity to have a serious conversation with him about where he was with God in quite some time. And I had a number of reasons to doubt that he was in a good place with God. And my real fear wasn't that he was doubting God's existence, but rather that he had rejected God in his heart. I was worried that he'd just skipped over the stage of doubting and had hardened his heart against taking God seriously in order to live for himself, much like I had done about his age. But anyway, when he was staying with me, we ended up having this brilliant 4-hour conversation late into the night where he shared very honestly with me about where he was in life and what he was learning and what he thought about God. And it turns out that actually he isn't sure where he is with God. And he realizes that he only really ever had our mum's faith, and he's unsure about whether God even exists. But that's not the end. He also said that he wants to know the truth, and he recognizes how important it is. And when he goes to uni, he plans to find Christians with whom he can engage with his questions and his doubts. And so I was actually really encouraged and relieved after this conversation. My fear had been that he wasn't sure if God existed, and he just didn't care. But the fact is that, yes, he's not sure if God exists, but he cares. And that makes a huge difference. Yes, he has really big doubts, but he hasn't pre-decided in his heart to give up on God before engaging his mind. And so I'm hugely optimistic that if he sincerely seeks truth, he will find God. And now, following on from that story, I had said that the story of Israel's rebellion helps us to see that there is a head and a heart component to both doubt and unbelief. And the Israelites didn't even engage their heads because they were so easily persuaded in their hearts. So when it comes to matters of doubt, it's always important that we assess what our hearts want. And I'll share a personal story to illustrate this. In the weeks leading up to my decision to submit to Jesus as Lord of my life, I remember chatting to a couple of Christian friends about my doubts, about how a good God could allow such extreme suffering as that which we see all around us. And after I'd spoken for a while, my friend Roger simply asked me, "Do you talk to God about this?" And I can't remember how I responded. I just remember feeling annoyed and thinking, well, obviously I talk to God about the thing that I would obviously speak to God about, apart from the fact that I don't speak to God about it ever, but shut up, go away. Because the honest answer would have been, no, I've never spoken to God about this. But the reality is, I think I probably just lied to him. And looking back, I see how hard-hearted I was. I dressed up my issue with God as a deep intellectual and heartfelt doubt, but the reality was that I wasn't sincerely looking for the truth. My expressed doubt was just an excuse to hold God at a distance and to resist putting my trust in Him. My doubts were just a cover-up for the fact that I wanted to be my own Lord without Jesus getting in the way. So I'd never really prayed about them, read anything, I'd barely discussed them, because that would require taking my doubts and the deeper heart issues seriously. So in talking about all this, I should say that being hard-hearted isn't the end of the world. In fact, I suspect we're probably all still hard-hearted to some degree, and the goal is that the Spirit will continually soften our hearts throughout our lives. But yeah, it's not the end of the world if we see some hardness of heart, and actually seeing it is a great start. It's not a dead end. And actually we read in Mark 6:52 that the disciples are described as having hard hearts at that point. And of course we know that over time their hearts were softened. So now I'm going to draw some of these threads together. I've scratched the surface of a number of areas of doubt. Doubts about ourselves and about God. Head doubts and heart doubts, and they all tend to be strongly linked together. So now I've got a few suggestions for when facing your own doubts. First, ask yourself, how is this doubt about God, and how is it about myself? Second, ask yourself, where is my heart in this doubt? Am I truly wanting to engage with this doubt and seek truth? Third, I just want to encourage you to know that you are free to doubt. And I'd suggest that doubt is often the birth pangs of a deepened faith. And fourth, I also want to add in the importance of sharing your doubt with others. And I'm going to spend a bit of time on that point just now. So, on the one hand, I'm quite happy for people to doubt. But what worries me is when people are having major doubts and they decide that they need space to figure it out on their own. They decide to disengage from prayer, from the Bible, from church, from Christian friends, in order to figure it out in their own heads, as if they were the only neutral person in the world. And when you see this, it's as if the decision has already been made in their heart. The reality is that we always need other people and other sources in order to figure out truth. To quote C.S. Lewis on this subject, he says, particularly about himself, 5 senses, an incurably abstract intellect, a haphazardly selective memory, a set of preconceptions and assumptions so numerous that I can never examine more than a minority of them, never become even conscious of them all. How much of total reality can such an apparatus let through? How much of total reality can my own mind figure out on its own? And the reality is we can't figure it out all by ourselves. And so now I want to say a little bit about ministering to others in their doubt to finish off. Jude verse 22 says, be merciful to those who doubt. And on the first day, Steve quoted Lost, those two questions. Why do you find it so hard to believe? Or why do you find it so easy to believe? So we probably know and recognize that some of us are natural doubters and some are not. My wife is certainly more of a natural doubter than I am. And regardless of where we fall on that spectrum, it's important that we learn to minister to others in their doubt. So you might have been in situations where you've expressed your doubt to someone and the other person has just given you a really patronizing answer. They might have given you the right answer, but managed to completely miss where you are, especially if you expressed a heartfelt struggle and all they did was try to offer the correct facts. But then, having said that, there are definitely times where people do really need to hear biblical truth in response to their doubts. To give a brief example, when I had my most acute and distressing doubts about my salvation, I really wasn't looking for someone just to listen to me and help me process and explore the issue. I was craving the truth. And ultimately, it was just hearing good theology on the subject that gave me really deep peace. And in considering how to respond to doubt and doubters, it's helpful to look at Jesus' example, always. Particularly in John 11, where he raises his friend Lazarus from the dead. So you can turn there as well if you want. When Jesus shows up on the scene, both of Lazarus' sisters, Martha and Mary, independently say the same words to Jesus. In verse 21 and verse 32, they both independently say, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But then we note that he responds very differently to both of them. And similarly, we need to exercise discernment in ministering to others in their doubt. So, we see with Martha, she says, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. And then she continues, but I know that even now God will give you whatever you ask. And then Jesus' response is interesting. He essentially responds with theological truth. Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. Martha answered, I know he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day. Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live, even though he dies. And whoever lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this? Yes, Lord. And so on. And then looking at his interaction with Mary is very different. So she asks the same question. Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. And then Jesus doesn't say anything in response to her. We read in John 11:33, when Jesus saw her weeping and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. Where have you laid him? He asked. Come and see, Lord, he replied. And then we have that famous short verse, Jesus wept. So Jesus' response to Mary's question is simply to weep with her. And it's interesting to think that actually both of these responses communicate the gospel profoundly in different ways. So we also need to ask, when confronted with people's doubts, do they simply need theological truth? Are they actually just looking for a debate? Is their question just a cover-up for a heart issue that they maybe don't even realize themselves? Do they just need someone to listen to them and process with them? Or do they even just need someone to cry with them? And when confronted with a question like, why did God allow this person to die so tragically young? The wise response probably isn't going to be some theological truth or speculation or saying God works everything for the good of those who love him. The wise response will probably, generally, be simply to share in their pain and weep with them. So, to conclude, we've looked at various forms of doubt and stories of doubt, and I offered a few practical suggestions in engaging your own doubts. I'll briefly recap them. So first, ask, how is this doubt about God? How is it about myself? Second, ask, where is my heart in this doubt? Am I truly willing to engage with this doubt? Or am I hardening my heart? Three, know that you are free to doubt. And fourth, share your doubt with others. And then I'm going to add one final semi-practical suggestion in responding to any doubt. And that's this. All doubts ultimately need to come back to Jesus. So is God good? Well, the answer is most clearly seen in the person of Jesus. Or how can God allow suffering? We're never going to find a short, simple answer to that question. There are important things that can be said in response, true things, but the greatest response to that question is not a neat theological formulation, but the cross of Christ. So, with that doubt, again, we look to Jesus and his cross. Or even with more seemingly intellectual doubts. So, is God real? Well, when I find myself asking that question, if I look to Jesus, it's there that I'm most aware that nobody made this up. No one made this guy up. Or in asking, is the Bible true? Again, we can look to Jesus and what he said about the authority of Scripture. He said some very important and helpful things about it. Or one of my biggest doubts and wrestles is around hell. I really struggle with the concept of hell, let alone the reality. But I think it's healthy, actually, to struggle with that. But the important response, again, is to come back to Jesus, to see his compassion, and to see the extent to which he went to provide salvation. And it's in looking to Jesus, and particularly, again, the cross, that we see most clearly the whatever doubts we might have, God isn't having doubts about you. That's where I want to finish. I'll just repeat that again. It's in looking to Jesus and his cross that we see most clearly that whatever doubts we might be struggling with, God is not having doubts about you. Let me pray. Father, you are good, and you are here, and you are listening, and you care. And we thank you so much that you have given us Jesus. And Lord, I'm aware that I've just been scratching the surface of a huge subject, but I ask that your Spirit would work in our hearts and help us to take away the things that you would have us remember, the things that could be helpful to us, and to forget and discard the things that could distract or confuse us. Please meet us in our doubts. In Jesus' name, amen. So I've got a few questions for you to consider and discuss in your small groups. First question might just be a short answer, and it's one that we've already engaged with a bit. Simply, are you a doubter, or where do you fall on that spectrum? And you could also think, in regard to your doubts, are they mostly focused on head or heart, or God or self? Of course, it's never just one, but... So, are you a doubter? Number two, what are your biggest or most nagging doubts? Number three, what sources most feed your level of hope and faith? So essentially, what boosts your faith? For example, being around certain people, listening to good news. So we're bombarded with good news, we're bombarded with bad news in the media. We hear the worst things that are happening in the world regularly, and they can be quite hard to see beyond and recognize the good news. Reading missionary biographies. I'm reading Hudson Taylor's. What's it called? Something About a Secret. Hudson Taylor's Big Secret. It's not exactly what it's called. I can show you it later, but good so far. One of my favorites is. Corrie Ten Boom, The Hiding Place, great faith booster. Or just sharing answers to prayer and thanksgivings with people. So, the question is, what sources feed your level of hope and faith? And then also, part B of that question is the opposite. What sources most damage your level of hope and faith? So, are there certain media sources or certain people? And finally, if you get around to it, big question, why are you a Christian? And that's not how did you become a Christian, but why are you a Christian, a follower of Jesus today? What are the reasons?